Okay, does anybody remember the question I said you need to, I'd like for you to think about? Anybody tell us what it was?
Something about what's the scariest thing that could happen to you or something like
that. Okay. I think I said it. What is the most dangerous thing you could face in life? Or and thinking about it some more, maybe that was worded too strong. Maybe I should have said it. Well, let me say it this way. In Africa, they have what they call the Dangerous Five or the Big Five, which is, let's see if I can get these. It's the elephant, the rhino, the hippopotamus, the lion, and the leopard. When we were in Kenya, we saw all five of those. And in reading and things, it's sort of interesting. I was trying to decide which one looked the most dangerous to me. I don't know, if you would have thrown me out of that vehicle close to any one of those, I would have been pretty much in awe of probably all of them. The rhino, the guide actually wanted us to walk through the bush with him to go find the thing. And stories I read about rhino, they have bad eyesight, and if they get spooked, they'll run at you, and they'll just basically split you wide open with their horns. So I don't know, of all those, probably the buffalo is almost the hardest. Actually, I'm getting something wrong with my numbers because the water buffalo's in there somewhere too. Anyway, missed that one. The water buffalo basically looks like a big black cow with big horns. And they're ugly, ugly as anything. So I don't know, like I said, those are all dangerous, and maybe I shouldn't have said the most dangerous. But of the things that you're likely to face, probably not most of us are going to face down a buffalo or a lion anytime soon. But of what you face, what do you think is some of the most dangerous? I just thought I'd be interested to stimulate your thoughts, see where they go. Deceitful heart. Let's see. Hope I'm spelling this right. Anyhow, you'll know what I mean. Okay, any others? Self, sure. It is, and yeah, adds maybe a different, slightly different dimension. I'll just capitalize it because I think we all know what that is. Anything more? Okay, I'm not sure. I don't want to write all day, but that's a comfortable Christian. Huh? Complacency, maybe we could call that. Be one word that sort of means. Spelling bee when you're a preacher sometimes. Okay, let's keep going. Anything else? Selfishness, so... action of self. Anybody else want to add anything? Oops.
This is probably similar to loving the world.
Love of the world. Okay, I'm not cutting anybody off. If you have something, go ahead.
The most obvious thing would be dying without Christ.
Dying without Christ? Okay. To die without Christ. Okay, so... in life, some dangers are what we call tangible, right? If I brought a line in here, you would have a tangible danger, or at least you would feel like you did. You could see it, you could sense it, you would be more than happy to get away from it. Some other dangers in life, such as probably most of these on this list, you can't really go out and touch them, and they probably aren't instant killers, but they have a trajectory towards death. And the one I probably, that I talk about sort of relates to all of them. I won't mention it right now. We'll come to it in a bit in how that works. But just because I think for me what happens is, well, let's just say it this way. In Kenya there, when we were out looking at these lions and things, there was these Maasai herders with their big herd of cattle. And they would be walking, I don't know, they were a couple hundred yards from the elephants in the vicinity of the lions with their cows. And if you would have made me get out of that safari vehicle, whatever, jeep thing, I would have been totally scared. But these fellows were walking there in their big colorful robes with a stick, and they seemed pretty happy-go-lucky about life. And I'm not saying they were being stupid, Dave. They probably knew how to read the animals and all that. At the same time, living with in the vicinity of dangerous game does bring complacency over time, right? If you live there, you grow up there, and you die there, unless you got a lion eater, a man eater, right, locally. Well, you know, they usually get out of the way. You have to go about your life. And in the same way, I think some of these things, and the one I want to mention, we sort of get used to it, and we sort of forget maybe the danger there. And so, for me, part of the inspiration for this was a story I was listening to, a book placed in China probably, I don't know, 50 to 75 years ago. And this farmer, and he faced famine and a number of things, but in listening to that story, he was always looking, well, at first he was always looking for land, and then land translated into money, and money translated into many other things. And towards the end of his life, he was always trying to have a peaceful home, but he went about it really messed up. He had a good wife, even though she wasn't pretty, he said, and had a number of boys, which was extremely important, but finally this wasn't good enough, so he had to go get another wife. And anyway, and it was sort of funny to me how he wanted peace, but the steps he'd taken took all his peace away. And that thought just struck me in thinking about this. I don't know if I'll share more about that story or not. So in moving on, there'd probably be a number of things, but I'd like to sort of use one of the strangest stories in the Bible as my basis this morning. So I don't know, does anybody want to try to guess? If you had to pick one of the strangest accounts in the Bible out, what would it be? Okay. Now, that would definitely be strange. It's not the one I have, but thank you. I was just sort of curious what comes to your mind when you say a strange story. So let's have two or three more. Jephthah, and is there where his offered whatever would come out, his daughter. Okay, thank you. Okay, the one there that then the other one came and brought him back to eat, and he was killed by a lion. Okay. Oh, mm-hmm. Judges 13 there, I believe, the Levite, yeah. Okay, good. Well, y'all missed the one I had. Mine is in Daniel 4, but those all qualify, I think, too. To me, this is just a strange story from start to finish in some ways. But Daniel chapter 4, we have a man with a big, long name. How much do you know about Nebuchadnezzar? Nebuchadnezzar. He was a king, and let's just read the first four verses. To a degree, I'd like for Nebuchadnezzar to talk to you this morning. So it's not every day you get a king preaching to you from a couple hundred years ago. So see what he says here. Daniel 4 is actually written from his perspective. It's part of Daniel, but this whole thing, this whole chapter is written as if Nebuchadnezzar was talking or writing it himself. So Daniel chapter 4, verse 1. Nebuchadnezzar, the king, unto all people, nations, and languages that dwell in the earth, peace be multiplied unto you. I thought it good to show the signs and wonders that the high God hath wrought toward me. How great are his signs, and how mighty are his wonders. His kingdom is an everlasting kingdom, and his dominion is from generation to generation. I, Nebuchadnezzar, was at rest in mine house and flourishing in my palace. Okay, let's just stop there briefly before we get on into his dream. What do you know about Nebuchadnezzar? How would you have classified him? Was he a measly little local king? Was he some for big shot? Who was Nebuchadnezzar? Just keep Jason's quiz going here. Anybody know anything about Nebuchadnezzar? So for his time and place, he was one of the world powers. I mean, there was like two at that point in time. So not just a local kingdom, really. Do you think the term successful you could have used that for Nebuchadnezzar? I think so. If you look on, I mean, if we don't have time to look, but he built, I think it was, am I getting confused? That was Babylon, that where they had the, wasn't it the Hanging Gardens? One of the seven ancient wonders of the world. I don't know how much of that was Nebuchadnezzar specifically, but he was a great. He conquered a lot of other countries, smaller countries. He built a tremendous capital city here. And so he was successful. Now let's see what happened to him. Daniel chapter 4, verse 5. He says, I saw a dream which made me afraid, and the thoughts upon my bed and the visions of my head troubled me. I don't know, do you have those? Now, Nebuchadnezzar, when he had visions in his head that troubled him, went about a little different than I do. I get up and go to work and decide that, by the grace of God, that doesn't mean anything at all. But Nebuchadnezzar, being king and all, I guess the East, the culture he lived in, thought dreams were rather important in understanding, maybe, future events. And so God often used those through interpretations to make a point. As he did in this case. So, Nebuchadnezzar, I'm going to sell this story for the children's sake rather than just reading it. Like I said, rather than just waking up crying like some people in our house do, he waked up and he was perplexed, and I think he didn't like it too well. So he called for the wise people, the people that were supposed to know things that nobody else knew, that they'd never been taught. And he called them around there. He says, this is what I dreamed. Now, what does it mean? Didn't work too well for him either, actually. He went the whole way down the line till he got to Daniel, which it calls Daniel the chief. I use that word, master, maybe. Which verse that is. So he brings Daniel up and he says, Daniel, I know the King James interpreted that of the holy gods, but you could have translated that of the holy God. He says, I know you're sort of strange for our culture. You serve one God, and I know that you have had insight into things nobody else did. So he said, here's my dream. And then he went on to tell him his dream. So his dream was basically this. I hope I don't skip the important points. But this dream was that this tree started growing, and this tree got bigger and bigger until it was what I call a landmark tree. Everybody traveling that way would say, yeah, you go till you get to that tree. It's a huge tree. It reached to heaven, it says, which basically means that it was could see it far and wide. And so this tree had birds in it. It had animals living underneath it. And this tree was a tree that did a lot of good, you could say. It was a well-known tree. But in Nebuchadnezzar's dream, a holy one, he calls it, let's say an angel, or somebody come and looked at this tree and they said, we're going to cut this tree down. We're going to knock all the leaves, the branches. We're going to get rid of this tree. The only thing we're going to let is a stump that we'll let in the ground for now. But we're going to completely get rid of this tree otherwise. And then he had a little funny thing here in verse 16, is it? Because he says, talking about this tree, they're going to let the stump there, and it's going to be wet with the dew of heaven. And it's, yeah, who pays attention to a stump? But in it, this tree, I guess, had a heart in his dream, because it says, let his heart be changed from a man's, and let a beast's heart be given unto him. Until 7 times, likely meaning 7 years, passes over. And so Nebuchadnezzar dreamed about this tree, and he's sitting there trying to understand, how could a tree have a heart? How could this heart be turned into a beast? What does this mean? And so he tells Daniel, I'd like to read verse 17. He says, this matter is by decree of the watchers or the angels, and they demand it by the word of the holy ones, to the intent that the living may know that the Most High ruleth in the kingdom of men, and giveth it to whomsoever he will, and setteth it up over the basest of men. Now right there, Nebuchadnezzar actually had a key, because he said these words. He said when he saw that angel come down, this angel said that the reason for cutting this tree down is that everybody who's alive really can know that there's something greater than themselves. And that this great being, this that's greater than any man, sets up and takes down how he wants to. But I guess he didn't catch it. Maybe he didn't want to catch it. I don't know. So then he sits there and he tells Daniel, tell me what this means. Which nobody else could tell me what this means. Now, I don't know. Daniel was in a real fix. Sometimes I think preaching isn't a whole lot of fun because it's hard to sometimes preach in a way that everybody appreciates or enjoys. But I think Daniel had a whole lot more ticklish situation than I did. You know what happens, children, if you told an old-time king something he didn't want to hear? Sometimes he would just get rid of you. Even the God's people, I mean, well, so to speak in name only, but put Jeremiah into the dungeon and all that. So if you look at verse 19, it says, Daniel, whose name was Belteshazzar, was astonished. And that word means stunned and troubled and amazed. So how's he going to interpret this dream to where Nebuchadnezzar is going to get some benefit out of it rather than just having himself killed? He said, so he was there quite a while. And finally, Nebuchadnezzar is like, you know, just tell me what this means. And so Daniel tells him in Daniel chapter 4, verse 20, the tree that thou sawest, which grew and was strong, whose height reached unto heaven, and was a sight thereof to all the earth, whose leaves were fair and the fruit thereof much, and in it was meat for all, under which the beasts of the field dwelt, and upon whose branches the fowls of the heaven had made their habitation. It is thou, O king. Thou art grown and become strong, for thy greatness is grown and reacheth unto heaven, and thy dominion unto the ends of the earth. And whereas the king saw a watcher and a holy one coming down from heaven and saying, hew the tree down and destroy it, yet leave the stump of the roots thereof in the earth, even with a band of iron and brass in the tender grass of the field, and let it be wet with the dew of heaven, and let his portion be with the beasts of the field till seven times pass over. This is the interpretation, O king, and this is the decree of the Most High, which has come upon my Lord. They shall drive thee from men. Thy dwelling shall be with the beasts of the field, and they shall make thee to eat grass as oxen, and they shall wet thee with the dew of heaven, and seven times shall pass over thee till thou know that the Most High ruleth in the kingdom of men and giveth it to whomsoever he will. So Daniel interprets verse 18 there again. And whereas they commanded to leave the stump of the tree roots, thy kingdom shall be sure unto thee after that thou shalt have known that the heavens do rule. Then notice Daniel's counsel or advice in verse 27. Wherefore, O king, let my counsel be acceptable unto thee, and break off thy sins by righteousness, and thine iniquities by showing mercy to the poor, if it may be a lengthening of thy tranquility. So now I guess part of this dream was sort of nice, right? Wouldn't it be nice having a dream saying how this tree is so big and so useful and so outstanding? That part was sort of nice. All of a sudden, though, this thing changed, and you, king, because you think you're something special, because you have a wrong view of where your power and your might comes from, are going to be cut down like that tree. I don't know, was Nebuchadnezzar a wise man? Doesn't really seem like it. He had this warning. Let's notice what happens. Daniel 4:28 now. All this came upon King Nebuchadnezzar. At the end of 12 months, he walked in the palace of the kingdom of Babylon. The king spake and said, is not this great Babylon that I have built for the house of the kingdom by the might of my power and for the honor of my majesty? I don't know how. You know, none of us has built a city. None of us has ruled an empire like Nebuchadnezzar did. So maybe none of us feels successful in the way that Nebuchadnezzar did. But I'd like to talk about dangerous success this morning. Dangerous success. So he's out there and he says, isn't this Babylon that I've built, the house of the kingdom, by the might of my power and for the honor of my majesty? Let's see what happens. Verse 31, while the word was in the king's mouth, there fell a voice from heaven saying, O King Nebuchadnezzar, to thee it is spoken, the kingdom is departed from thee. And they shall drive thee from men, And thy dwelling shall be with the beasts of the field, and they shall make thee to eat grass as oxen, and seven times shall pass over thee, until thou know that the Most High ruleth in the kingdom of men, and giveth it to whomsoever he will. The same hour was that thing fulfilled upon Nebuchadnezzar, and he was driven from men, and did eat grass as oxen. His body was wet with the dew of heaven, till his hairs were grown like eagle's feathers, and his nails like bird's claws. And at the end of the days, at the end of the 7 years, I, Nebuchadnezzar, lifted up mine eyes unto heaven, and mine understanding returned unto me. And I blessed the Most High, and I praised and honored him that liveth forever, whose dominion is an everlasting dominion, and his kingdom is from generation to generation. And all the inhabitants of the earth are reputed as nothing. He doeth according to his will in the army of heaven, and among the inhabitants of the earth none can stay his hand or say unto him, what doest thou? At the same time that he did this, that he gave this glory and praise, at the same time my reason returned unto me, and for the glory of my kingdom, mine honor and brightness, maybe you could say his mental abilities, returned unto me, and my counselors and my lords sought unto me, and I was established in my kingdom, and excellent majesty was added unto me. Notice verse 37. Now I, Nebuchadnezzar, praise and extol and honor the King of heaven, all whose works are truth and his ways judgment, and those that walk in pride he is able to abase. Okay, I'd like for you all to do something. Like I said, none of us has a Babylon to build. None of us can do hanging gardens and all that. But I would like to suggest every one of us has something that's very important to us, right? It can be work. It can be checking accounts. It can be what other people think. There's an endless list. But think of something that is very important to you in your life. Okay, second question, not necessarily that you're supposed to answer these. But are you successful in that area? Maybe some will say yes. Maybe some will say no. Others say, well, I try to be, but it's a long, hard road, huh? Maybe another question that's a little easier. Would you like to be successful in that area? I think we'd all say yes, right? If something's important to us, we would like to excel, to have it work out well. Now think about it a minute. Have you seen people be successful in the area you're thinking of? Maybe you yourself are successful. If you're not, have you seen someone else? What temptation goes with that success? What snares have those who you would say are successful, what have they fallen into? Now I'd like to tell you this. I'm not preaching this message because I was struggling with feeling like a success. Because here's where it gets a little difficult is probably, I would say most any human enjoys feeling like a success. Probably the bigger problem that we perceive is when we are a failure in our own eyes, right? When I feel like I'm just a mess. At least for myself, generally when I struggle, it's because I feel like the opposite of a success. But I'd like to suggest to you that the mindset that makes success dangerous begins and comes whether you're successful or not. Would you agree with that? So let's say that I don't know that it is really, used to probably be, but let's say that it would be my goal that I would say I was a success if I had $1 million in my bank account. The mindset that would make that dangerous for me to achieve would actually be there whether I had that money or not, correct? Because if that was my goal, if that was my emphasis, I would still have that, I would still relate in a way whether I had it or not. So whether you feel like a success or a failure doesn't matter as much. You don't get a free pass on the rest of this. Even those of us who view ourselves as maybe struggle or a bit of a failure still struggle with a proper understanding of what constitutes success. I'd like to throw a few things out there for you to think about. I'm not saying I see all this correctly. But let's say you feel like a failure. Do you suppose that that may actually be God's mercy to you in whatever area you're feeling like a failure? And this can happen a lot of ways. When I say success, I'm not thinking necessarily materially. In fact, I think sometimes it's more sinister in parenting. Maybe other aspects of working with people, relationships, or even maybe more dangerous. I don't know. I can't rate it. But I've reached a conclusion that for myself, failure may be the grace of God in action to those who trust themselves. Does that make sense? Like if I am trusting in myself, and I am trying to win this battle, to reach this goal, to do this thing in my own strength, if God was to allow me to be successful in that way, what do you think would happen to me? And I'd like to give you a few instances then. You know, regardless of personality type, background, or training, success in what matters to us, I'm going to say, is one of the most universally dangerous things a human being can experience because of what it does to us. So I think success is a water buffalo. It doesn't really look. In fact, it's not a water buffalo in that. It sort of looks attractive to me. At the same time, I think it's dangerous. There's a real hidden danger there. I'd like to look at the three dangers of success. You could do this a lot of ways. I have three. So three I have is what I'm going to call pride and the selfisms. Second one is the problem of the danger is of identifying ourselves with what we perceive as our successes and rate ourselves as more valuable according to our measure of success. And then the third one is we have a predilection, or I should say a tendency of supposing success in one area translates into making us more successful in other areas. So if you're sitting here and you're saying, you're crazy talking about success, I've been anything but a success, hang on. I'd like to ask you one question, is that have you thanked God for failure? Maybe that sounds loopy, but I really think that's what he wants me to do. Is because in that, I'm not accusing God of failure, but have I asked God to help me see what he wants to accomplish in my life through this failure? So let's look at this a bit. Pride and selfisms are the first two dangers. Could I read another interesting account in the Bible to me is Matthew chapter 12. Maybe you all have these verses figured out. There's some verses that I've looked at and explained one way, explained another way. I think I finally came up with a way that makes a lot of sense to me. Maybe you'll still have a different way, and that's fine. But Matthew chapter 12, verse 43, we have Christ speaking, and he gives this account of something that just didn't make a lot of sense to me over the years. So 12:43, he says, "When an unclean spirit is gone out of a man, he walketh through the dry places seeking rest and findeth none. Then he saith, I will return unto my house from whence I came out, and when he is come, he findeth it empty, swept, and garnished. Then goeth he and taketh with himself seven other spirits more wicked than himself, and they enter in and dwell there, and the last state of that man is worse than the first. Even so shall it be unto this wicked generation." I guess you can read that and dismiss it as Christ talking to the Jews in his day, and he was, but I think he's talking to me today. So when an unclean spirit is gone out of a man, so this spirit leaves. And he goes somewhere else. It calls it to the dry places seeking rest. So let's just apply that to myself. As I become aware of the spiritual battle that's occurring within me, and with the training and things I have, I know that I need Christ in my heart and life. Maybe there comes a day where I ask Christ to help me with my battle. I say, God, you know, I don't want to be whatever the negatives I am that I'm seeing in my life. Please help me with this. And at that time, Christ comes and helps me clean out the place. But what so often happens, especially for those of us that have grown up in Christian homes, I feel like, in looking at myself, is we're not really willing to be 100% sold out to God. We're happy to have those negatives leave, right? We're happy to have help with lust. We're happy to have help with covetousness. We're happy to have help with the negatives, attitudes and all that. But it looks, yeah, you know what? Even in a Mennonite Anabaptist setting, to be sold out for God, to be on fire for Christ, it still makes you somewhat conspicuous. And you say, no, God, I just want enough. I don't want the problems, but neither do I want to be a radical. And I think that's where this next part happens. So when Christ doesn't fully move into a heart, it lets that heart, in my way of thinking, empty. And so then that spirit is wandering around, and he says, I'm going to go back to where I came from, the heart I came out of, from whence I came out, verse 44. And when he is come, he findeth it. Notice this. When he is come, he findeth it empty, swept, and garnished. He finds it cleaned up. He finds it maybe better than a better condition, definitely, than when he left. But it's not filled up with Christ. It's not filled up with something different and better. Cleaned, but not occupied. Not filled with praise, with thanksgiving, with wonder and amazement at the love of Christ. Then that brings us to 12:45. Then goeth he, talking of the evil spirit, the negative in the life, and taketh with himself seven other spirits more wicked than himself. Notice that. And they enter in and dwell there, and the last state of that man is worse than the first. Even so shall it be unto this wicked generation. Here's where I think success, if you want to call it, in spiritual life, is maybe the most dangerous animal you can face. In that as we cry out to Christ for help, if that house becomes clean without being sold out to Christ, it now is susceptible to not only the lusts, but what I'm going to call the greater spiritual sins. And I'm not trying to rate sin by saying that necessarily, but I came up with seven. I don't know. Maybe these aren't clear. But the first one is pride. You know, when I was under conviction, sure, I struggled with pride, but it was a pride more in what I had and what people thought about me. And a certain element of that remains, but sometimes now there can be actually what we call spiritual pride, where we're proud of the knowledge we think we have about God's Word, where we feel we're better than those. Remember that Pharisee standing up there praying, I thank you, God, that I'm not like other men are, even like this publican. I'm better. I'm something special. Spiritual pride. And I would like to suggest to you, spiritual pride is much more deceptive than somebody that's living for the flesh. Second one I have is self-righteousness. And it ties directly in with pride. I don't think you can be one maybe without being the other, but I've got it together. I'm better than that publican, than that brother, that sister. I thank God I'm not like. Third one, self-sufficiency. I can handle it. I've got it together. That publican is such a clear example of it. He's praying to God about his goodness, and he didn't have any. But self-sufficiency, I can handle it. I don't need the help and input of others, especially not you. And the reason I say that is, isn't it amazing how often it seems like in my life God uses the person I thought had a need? Is it because he needs me to be humble? Anyway, going on, and to need that person. The fourth one I have is self-confidence. I have the answers. I know how to help not only myself, but how to help you. I got it, or I can get it. The fifth spirit that's worse is one I'm going to call a critical spirit. This one scares me probably as bad as any of them. And that I think we have it more than what we realize. Can I say it this way? Critical spirit, if others thought or did as I do, we would all be better off. Friends, that's not true. That's not true. That ties right back into pride. I should welcome a different thought of an opinion. Not saying that the other one's right, but if I've got a critical spirit, I won't be able to listen to it. If I'm making other people a problem in the home, in the church, I think unfailingly that problem actually starts in my own life. The sixth spirit we actually have up on the board here, complacency. I'd like to just describe that spirit as just being pretty happy with how I look at stuff. Whenever there's this discussion, yeah, brothers, I know, I can explain this to you. Complacency. Just happy with my views, with my life, with where I'm at. If the rest of you would catch the vision I have, what a church we'd have. The last one I have is self-deception. And these are all sort of building on each other, but the last spirit of self-deception, I think, ties right into all these, making all these seven spirits worse than the first, if you will, in that I don't think there's any deception like the self-deceived Christian. Because he can stand up, give a testimony. He can stand up, say all the right words. He can stand up and give an answer that on the face sounds good, but his heart is not in the answer. His heart is in self. Just listen to these verses from 2 Peter chapter 2, verse 19 through 22. I'll just read them, you listen. Notice this. He's talking about evil people. But notice, I think this happens in my own life anyhow. Verse 19, while they promise them liberty, in other words, I as a self-deceived Christian can be promising liberty to other people. While they promise them liberty, they themselves are the servants of corruption. They are the servants of pride, of self-righteousness, self-sufficiency, self-confidence, a critical spirit, and complacency. They themselves are the servants of corruption. For of whom a man is overcome, of the same is he brought in bondage. Do you understand that? That's saying that if pride overcomes me, I am now brought into bondage by pride. If my critical spirit overcomes me, I am now brought in bondage by a critical spirit. You are not free if you're struggling with these things. For if after they have escaped the pollutions of the world through the knowledge of the Lord and Savior Jesus Christ. So this is somebody who knew the truth. This is somebody who cried out to God for help. But it says, they are again entangled therein and overcome. The latter end is worse with them than the beginning. Saying the same thing it said in Matthew. That if I started out a sinner and I knew I was a sinner, but I called out to God for help, he helped me clean up the house, but I wasn't willing to let him move in, my last end is a lot worse than if I had never started and just stayed with the sins of the flesh. For, he goes on, 21, for it had been better for them not to have known the way of righteousness, then after that they had known it, to turn from the holy commandment delivered unto them and pretend to be something, my words, that they aren't. But it is so happened unto them, according to the true proverb, the dog is turned to his own vomit again, and the sow that was washed to her wallowing in the mare. He's saying it's like taking a pig and washing it up all nice and clean, but right back to the mud it goes. But you know, here again I'd like to say, the second time that pig gets dirty is a lot worse than the first. Because the first time they were dirty, everybody knew they were dirty. Oftentimes, the second time that pig gets dirty, and talking about myself in that way, I get pretty good at hiding it. And that's how it's worse. I'd like to say this carefully, and I hope you can follow me here. I firmly believe it is not God's will for anyone to live in failure and in sin. Yet I would like to suggest to you that where spiritual pride and a reliance on self are a problem and would be the outcome if God gave his strength to you in the struggle you face, I believe God deliberately withholds his strength from you lest your last end be worse than your first. You follow me? And I think sometimes as Christians we can see, why God, I did that for years. Why God, why can't you help me? And I still struggle with this. You know, I'd like to be rid of this problem. Just take it away. But you know what happens is I want that house cleaned without having that heart filled. And I don't think God actually in his mercy doesn't do it. At least not always. Because you know what? If he cleaned that house without me really realizing that I need him in that heart, it would make me feel like a success to where I would depend on myself again. And he's actually, if I can read the word of God clearly and correct me if I'm wrong, but he's actually, in my understanding, saying that would be worse than for somebody to continue struggling with that sin. I believe God withholds his strength lest the last end be worse than the first when we're unwilling to see spiritual pride, self-righteousness, and all these things. May I suggest to you that as long as self in any way, shape, or form is on the throne of my heart, God almost has no option but to allow me to continue falling. Because if self is on that throne and he gives victory to somebody that has self on the throne, now you've just made somebody that controls their own destiny. What God wants or must have from all his children is a humble realization of their nothingness. He needs them to have an amazement at his love and care, a willingness to give all honor and glory to him, the one who overrules and directs in all things. And thinking about success, Christ measures the success of his children by their reliance on him. And by the realization that they have, that any success they have is because of him. God's not looking for somebody that can go out there and live a Christian life without him in their heart. He wants somebody that needs to hold to his hand each and every moment of each day. The second danger in success is we identify ourselves with what we perceive as our success. And then we begin to rate ourselves as more valuable according to the measure of our success. Can you follow that? In other words, if what's important to me is raising children that think just like me, the better my children turn out just like I am, the more pride there will be in my heart. Can you follow that? Because after all, I did this. We begin to identify with what we perceive as our success, and then we rate our valuableness based on our measure of success. We fail to see and understand ourselves as unprofitable servants who are simply honored to have the opportunity to serve. Do I want my children to know Christ? Do I want to be a successful parent? Absolutely. At the same time, I dare not rate myself by that. Maybe I just given myself away. I know it's this way for me. I think it's this way for others. But I feel we as humans unfailingly overrate our contribution to success. You know, Nebuchadnezzar walking out there, isn't this great Babylon that I have built? If Nebuchadnezzar actually got all that done, you know how he did it? By having good advisors. Good overseers, good engineers, good workers, right? He didn't go out there and lay those bricks. He overrated himself. I think if you feel like a success this morning, you're overrating yourself. On the other hand, if you feel like a failure, you're probably overrating yourself in a sort of a contortion. But I did it. You can notice that in Nebuchadnezzar. We did it. Really. Luke 17, verse 7 says this, "But which of you, having a servant plowing or feeding cattle, will say unto him by and by when he has come from the field, go sit down to meat. And will not rather say unto him, make ready wherewith I may sup and gird thyself and serve me till I have eaten and drunken and afterward thou shalt eat and drink. Does this master thank that servant because he did the things that he commanded him? I think not. I trow not. So likewise ye, when ye have done all those things which are commanded, you say, we are unprofitable servants, we have done that which is our duty to do. I don't know, this is a little scary, but I find that myself, and I think some other Christians too, when you do manage to live a life of obedience, don't you almost feel like God owes you something? I denied myself. I did the right thing there. I looked the other way. I didn't have pride. I tried to get rid of that bad attitude. So now, payday's coming up, right? Do you notice that's not at all the attitude he's talking about here? God owes you nothing just because you live a life of obedience. That's a privilege. Christ measures the success of his children by their gratitude for having the opportunity to be of service to him. Okay, and the last one, danger of success, is we have a predilection or tendency of supposing success in one area translates into success in another area. Now, I want to be careful here. There's a certain amount of truth here, right? It's a biblical principle that if a man is faithful in small things, he'll be faithful in much. I'm not trying to undermine that. But I see people, I see myself having sort of a sweeping thing where if this person does well here, I just sort of expect them to do better in another area. And that's very dangerous. Maybe this is most easily seen when you think of other people. I don't guess any of you do that, right? You never think about other people and how they do or don't do things, but I think I do. So think about this for a minute. How do you rate other people, or how do you think of others? What makes them outstanding to you? This man did not live in Arkansas, so I guess I'm free to share. But I know one individual that he totally rated people by what time they got their farm paid off. And he would actually go as far as telling people, yeah, that man's 45 and don't have his farm paid. Negative. Really? I mean, it sure would be nice to have your farm paid at 45. I can't argue that. But really, is that how you determine whether somebody is valuable? And maybe this comes pretty close home. I don't hope I'm not inserting this in a wrong way here. But let's just think about we're planning for deacon ordination this fall. So, as we seek God's face in that, let me just ask a question. What qualities of qualification do I look for? Do I look for somebody that's successful in the way I think of it, or do I look at somebody that's a success in God's way? And I think we can be a bit dismissive. We're surrounded by people that and groups that like to preach health and wealth sort of equation. You know what I'm talking about. And we would never believe that. We dismiss that, right? But do we? I would suggest to you that we're influenced by that. I have heard people that have a hard time, and I know I'd do the same thing myself, depending on what had happened to me. But the thought is, when something bad happens, what did I do wrong, really? Think of Job. Was it something he did wrong, or was it God just trying to build a stronger Job? What did I do wrong? Well, if you've been living in sin, by all means, yeah, you did something wrong. Fix it. On the other hand, just because I suffer a setback, just because my day doesn't good, doesn't necessarily mean I did something wrong. It means that God has something he wants to do in me. And I don't know, I'm not saying this has ever happened here, but I have seen it happen. Why is it that the person that does well in business maybe gets a pass for some things in church life where the brother that struggles in business doesn't it? Gets, he needs some help. We need to work with him on that. Really? I'm not saying we don't. Maybe we need to work with both. Notice Luke chapter 12, verse 15. I'll read a verse. And he said unto them, Christ speaking, says, take heed and beware of covetousness. For a man's life consisteth not in the abundance of the things which he possesseth. Now, I don't know about you, but I struggle believing that verse. If I go work for a fellow that lives in $1 million house and drives a new pickup versus one that has 20 cats in the garage and I'd rather never be on the property, I find it really hard not to sort of think that a man's life does somewhat consist of what he possesses. And maybe in small ways it does. But you know, if I start rating people by that, Christ is saying I'm covetous, I think. If I can read that verse, it's a little bit of a different twist on it. You know, Christ equates esteeming someone that has material success as covetousness. If I think about myself in one or all of these ways, if I rate other people by one or all of these ways, do you think that God has any option but allowing me to continue to fail? Because if he gave me victory, as long as I'm looking at all these things right, it wouldn't build a Christian. It'd build a self-righteous person. God measures the success of his children not by how much they have in their bank account, not by what others say or think about them, not by how things either go or don't go for them, but God rates his children as a success when they humbly realize that all they have, all they are, all they ever hope to be is because of him, and that there's no honor, glory, or praise due the individual at all, but simply the awesomeness of being able to serve him today. How do you rate success? Can we kneel for prayer?